bad attitude I had against the other churches I'd gone to. In the end, I was just different, you know. It wasn't that they were bad, they just didn't do it for me. I read through the book of Ephesians 4 times one night in Eugene Peterson's The Message, and it seemed to me that Paul did not want Christians to fight with one another. He seemed to care a great deal about this, so, in my mind, I had to tell my heart to love the people at the churches I used to go to, the people who were different from me. This was entirely freeing because when I told my heart to do this, my heart did it. And now I think very fondly of those wacko Republican fundamentalists, and I know that they love me too, and I know that we will eat together, we will break bread together in heaven, and we will love each other so purely it will hurt because we are a family in Christ. So here is a step-by-step formula for how you too can go to church without getting angry. Pray that God will show you a church filled with people who share your interests and values. Go to the church God shows you. Don't hold grudges against any other churches. God loves those churches almost as much as He loves yours. Chapter 13. Romance. Meeting girls is easy. My friend Kurt used to say finding a wife is a percentage game. He said you have to have 2 or 3 relationships going at once, never letting the one girl know about the others, always moving in to close the deal. One of them, he said, is bound to work out, and if you lose one, you just pick up another. Kurt believed you had to date about 20 girls before you found the one you were going to marry. He just believed it was easier to date them all at once. Kurt ended up marrying a girl from Dallas, and everybody says he married her for her money. He is very happy. Elsewhere in the quandary is my friend Josh. When I first moved to Oregon, I was befriended by this vibrant kid who read a lot of the Bible. Josh was good-looking and obsessed with dating, philosophies of dating, social rituals, and that sort of thing. He was homeschooled and raised to believe traditional dating was a bad idea. I traveled with him around the country and introduced him at seminars he would conduct on the pitfalls of dating. He wrote a book about it, and it hit the bestseller list. No kidding. A couple years later, he moved to Baltimore and got married. I called him after the wedding and asked him how he got to know his wife without dating. He said they courted, which I understood to mean he had become Amish. But he explained courting is a lot like dating without the head games. He and his wife are also very happy. My friend Mike Tucker reads books about dating and knows a lot on the subject. He says things like, "You know, Don, relationships are like rubber bands. When one person pulls away, the other is attracted. And when the other person pulls away, well, that just draws the other one even closer." That sort of thing is interesting to a guy like me because I know nothing about dating. What little I know about dating is ridiculous and wouldn't help rabbits reproduce. I know you shouldn't make fun of a girl on a date and you shouldn't eat spaghetti. Other than these two things, I am clueless. Here's a tip I've never used. I understand you can learn a great deal about girldom by reading Pride and Prejudice, and I own a copy, but I have never read it. I tried. It was given to me by a girl with a little note inside that read, "What is in this book is the heart of a woman." I am sure the heart of a woman is pure and lovely, but the first chapter of said heart is hopelessly boring. Nobody dies at all. I keep the book on my shelf because girls come into my room, sit on my couch, and eye the books on the adjacent shelf. "You have a copy of Pride and Prejudice," they exclaim in a gentle sigh and smile. "Yes," I say. "Yes, I do." Not long ago, I went to Yosemite with my Canadian friend, Julie. I have a weakness for Canadian girls. I don't know why, but when a Canadian girl asks me what I am thinking about, I go nuts. So I have had this secret crush on Julie for a while, but she likes guys who surf and skateboard and jump out of airplanes with snowboards. I pretty much don't fit that description. I read books by dead guys. This is my identity. Besides, when Julie and I met, I was in a relationship with a cute writer from the South, and Julie liked some other guy who could skateboard and play guitar. The thing with the writer didn't work out, however, because though we had everything in common, we could not connect in the soul. So it happened that I was speaking in San Francisco, and Julie was traveling around California and happened to be in a hostel in the city while I was there. So I went to pick her up, and later we were driving through the Sierra Nevadas, and I was nervous because she was much prettier than I remembered, and we were making small talk about what we wanted in a mate, what we expected in marriage, and that sort of thing. I kept wanting to say, well, I want a tall Canadian girl who sings and plays the guitar and is, not Alanis Morissette. But I couldn't say that because Julie would have been on to me. So I just told her I wanted a girl who would be a good mom, a girl who could go deep and meaningful with me spiritually, a girl who was good in bed. I said all the cliché stuff, the stuff that has been true for centuries. But then I opened my big, stupid mouth and said that I thought, honestly, there really wasn't any such thing as true, true love. I was feeling tired when I said it. I don't know why I said it. I kept talking with my stupid mouth. I told her that love, or what we call love, is mostly teamwork, and that quite possibly I would get a crush on another woman after I had been married for a while. I also mentioned that my wife might become attracted to another man. The stuff that attracts us to other people doesn't shut down just because we walk down the aisle, I said. I was going on like this, being a realist and all, and I suspect I was saying stupid things like this because I have not read Pride and Prejudice, because it turns out these ideas are not the keys to a woman's heart. Julie believed that there was such a thing as true love, and she would be in love with her mate forever, and that he would be in love with her forever, too. Julie hated my ideas. She said nothing like that would ever happen to her, that her husband would love her passionately and adore her until one of them died. She did not really want to talk about my ideas. I just sat there feeling stupid. I do this a great deal in my life. The next day, on the way to Santa Cruz, I told her I had a crush on her, which was stupid because I knew she didn't feel the same. I was only hoping she did. I did it very stupidly, very sheepishly. I just sort of stumbled around in my mouth, and my heart was beating very fast. Julie was very kind, but we sort of let it go and pretended the idea was never spoken. The rest of the time we made small talk and listened to Patty Griffin, which was helpful because Patty Griffin has always been very comforting to me. I think if you like somebody, you have to tell them. It might be embarrassing to say it, but you will never regret stepping up. I know from personal experience, however, that you should not keep telling a girl that you like her after she tells you she isn't into it. You should not keep riding your bike by her house, either. I don't want to get married right away. I think it will take me a while after I meet a girl. I like being single. I am one of the few who like it. I want to marry a girl who, when I am with her, makes me feel alone. I guess what I'm saying is I want to marry a girl whom I feel completely comfortable with, comfortable being myself. I can be very immature and awkward in moments, and I want to be able to be like that with her and not have her walk away or be embarrassed. I've had about 50 people tell me that I fear intimacy, and it is true. I fear what people will think of me, and that is the reason I don't date very often. People really like me a lot when they only know me a little, but I have this great fear that if they knew me a lot, they wouldn't like me. That is the number one thing that scares me about having a wife, because she would have to know me pretty well in order to marry me, and I think if she got to know me pretty well, she wouldn't like me anymore. My best friend Paul married my friend Danielle. People change when they get married, it is true. Danielle was a fiery feminist when she married Paul. Now she isn't so much a feminist, or at least she isn't active. She is very much in love with him and he with her. Sometimes when I am visiting them, they grab each other's butts as if I am not even in the room. It's embarrassing. People shouldn't grab each other's butts with me sitting there in the room. Paul and Danielle have been married almost 7 years and have 3 children, 3 girls. I was in the wedding. I read a poem. I look incredibly handsome and skinny in the pictures. Paul looked like Brad Pitt, and Danielle, who was hopelessly beautiful, looked like a flower or a beautiful painting. For a while after the wedding, we all lived together in an enormous old house on Kearney Street in Portland. It was Wes and Maya's house, Danielle's aunt and uncle. The house once belonged to the Hall of Fame basketball player Bill Walton, and they say when Patty Hearst was kidnapped by the SLA, she was held captive in the basement. The old guy who lived next door said Walton used to have the Grateful Dead over, and they would do concerts on the porch. On a dry day, you can smell the marijuana residue in the woodwork. It was an enormous house, and I lived in the attic. Paul and Danielle lived in the grand room, which was big enough to make into an apartment. Occasionally, Paul would come up to the attic, and we would crawl out the window to the roof, where we would smoke pipes above the city. "How's married life?" I once asked. "It's good. It's tough, but it's good." "What's tough about it?" I asked. Paul is the only person I know who is completely comfortable in his own skin, completely true in what he says. He is what they call a true person. You know, Don, marriage is worth the trade. You lose all your freedom, but you get this friend. This incredible friend. I wondered about that when he said it. The idea of marriage is remarkably frightening to me for precisely this reason: the loss of freedom. I am not somebody who needs constant company. I don't often get lonely. I live in community because it is healthy, because people who live alone for too long are more likely to go goofy. But the idea of coming home to a woman day after day, living in the same house and sharing a bath and a bed and having things pink and silky lying around on the floor strikes this chord in me like a prison door clanging shut. I can just see myself standing there watching her take her makeup off in the bathroom and thinking, she really isn't going to leave. All her stuff is here now. Tony the Beat Poet says I am finicky. The longest I have been in love is 8 minutes. That really isn't true. I just get crushes very quickly, like lightning or something, and then they go away. Mostly they go away because I am afraid to do anything about them. I am afraid of rejection, and I am afraid that I won't feel the same way tomorrow, and I have no faith in the system that God made. Penny says I have a skewed view of relationships because I have issues with intimacy, and when I talk to Nadine about girls, she just looks at me with her dignified stare, making knowing noises like a therapist. "That's interesting," she says to me. "Very interesting." I know they all think I'm selfish. And I am. I want a girl, but I want her every few days, not every day. I want her to have her own house and to come over only when I feel like shaving. It isn't what you think it is, Don. Paul takes his gaze from the city and eyes the pipe in his hand. He turns it over and taps the top ash onto the roof, rolling the embers under his sneakers. What isn't? Marriage. He looks me in the eye. It isn't fulfilling in the way you think it is. Paul, will you be honest with me if I ask you something?
Yes.
Are you happy?
Define happy.
Are you glad you married Danielle? Paul puts the stem of his pipe back in his mouth.
I am happy, Don. I am very happy.
What do you mean it isn't what I think it is, then?
I was expecting him to talk about sex. Well, maybe I can't say what you think marriage is. Maybe I should say it isn't what I thought it would be. I thought to be married was to be known. And it is to be known. But Danielle can only know me so much. Do you know what I mean? There are things you haven't told her? I ask. I've told her everything. Then I don't know what you're saying. Paul pushed himself up a little to the pitch of the roof from which you can see the Portland skyline. I joined him. We all want to be loved, right? Right. And the scary thing about relationships, intimate relationships, is that if somebody gets to know us, the us that we usually hide, they might not love us. They might reject us. Right, I tell him. Paul continued. I'm saying there is stuff I can't tell her, not because I don't want to, but because there aren't words. It's like we are separate people, and there's no getting inside each other to read each other's thoughts, each other's beings. Marriage is amazing because it is the closest two people can get, but they can't get all the way to that place of absolute knowing. Marriage is the most beautiful thing I have ever dreamed of, Don, but it isn't everything. It isn't Mecca. Danielle loves everything about me. She accepts me and tolerates me and encourages me. She knows me better than anybody else in the world, but she doesn't know all of me, and I don't know all of her. And I never thought after I got married there would still be something lacking. I always thought marriage, especially after I first met Danielle, would be the ultimate fulfillment. It is great, don't get me wrong. And I am glad I married Danielle, and I will be with her forever. But there are places in our lives that only God can go. So marriage isn't all that it's cracked up to be? I ask. No, it is so much more than I ever thought it would be. One of the ways God shows me he loves me is through Danielle. And one of the ways God shows Danielle he loves her is through me. And because she loves me and teaches me that I am lovable, I can better interact with God. What do you mean? I mean that to be in a relationship with God is to be loved purely and furiously. And a person who thinks himself unlovable cannot be in a relationship with God because he can't accept who God is, a being that is love. We learn that we are lovable or unlovable from other people, Paul says. That is why God tells us so many times to love each other. When the sky got dark, Paul and I went back into the attic. We made small talk for an hour before he went downstairs to be with his wife, but I kept thinking about these things. I turned out the light and lay in my bed and thought about the girls I had dated, the fear I have of getting married, and the incredible selfishness from which I navigate my existence. I had been working on a play called Polaroids that year. It was the story of one man's life from birth to death, each scene delivered through a monologue with other actors silently acting out parts behind the narrator as he walks the audience through his life journey. In the scene I had written a few nights before, I had the man fighting with his wife. They were experiencing unbearable tension after losing a son in a car accident the year before. I knew in my heart they were not going to make it, that Polaroids would include a painful divorce that showed the ugliness of separation. But I changed my mind. After talking with Paul, I couldn't do it. I wondered what it would look like to have the couple stick it out. I got up and turned on my computer. I had the lead character in my play walk into the bedroom where his wife was sleeping. I had him kneel down by her and whisper some lines. What great gravity is this that drew my soul toward yours? What great force that though I went falsely, went kicking, went disguising myself to earn your love, also disguised, to earn your keeping, your resting, your staying, your will fleshed into mine, rasped by a slowly revealed truth, the barter of my soul, the soul that I fear, the soul that I loathe, the soul that, if you will love, I will love. I will redeem you. if you will redeem me? Is this our purpose? You and I together to pacify each other, to lead each other toward the lie that we are good, that we are noble, that we need not redemption save the one that you and I invented of our own clay? I am not scared of you, my love. I am scared of me. I went looking. I wrote out a list. I drew an image. I bled a poem of you. You were pretty, and my friends believed I was worthy of you. You were clever, but I was smarter, perhaps the only one smarter, the only one able to lead you. You see, love, I did not love you. I loved me. And you were only a tool that I used to fix myself, to fool myself, to redeem myself. And though I have taught you to lay your lily hand in mine, I walk alone, for I cannot talk to you, lest you talk it back to me, lest I believe that I am not worthy, not deserving, not redeemed. I want desperately for you to be my friend, but you are not my friend. You have slid up warmly to the man I wanted to be, the man I pretended to be, and I was your Jesus, and you were mine. Should I show you who I am, we may crumble. I am not scared of you, my love. I am scared of me. I want to be known and loved anyway. Can you do this? I trust by your easy breathing that you are human like me, that you are fallen like me, that you are lonely like me. My love, do I know you? What is this great gravity that pulls us so painfully toward each other? Why do we not connect? Will we be forever in fleshing this out? And how will we, with words, narrow words, come into the knowing of each other? Is this God's way of meriting grace? Of teaching us of the labyrinth of his love for us, teaching us in degrees, that which he is sacrificing to join ourselves to him? Or better yet, has he formed our being fractional so that we might conclude one great hope, plodding and sighing and breathing into one another in such a great push that we might break through into the known and being loved, only to cave into a greater perdition and fall down at his throne, still begging for our acceptance, begging for our completion? We were fools to believe that we would redeem each other. Were I some sleeping Adam, to wake and find you resting at my rib, to share these things that God has done, to walk you through the garden, to counsel your timid steps, your bewildered eye, your heart so slow to love, so careful to love, so sheepish that I stepped up my aim and became a man. Is this what God intended? That though he made you from my rib, it is you who is making me, humbling me, destroying me, and in so doing revealing him. Will we be in ashes before we are one? What great gravity is this that drew my heart toward yours? What great force collapsed my orbit, my lonesome state? What is this that wants in me the want in you? Don't we go at each other with yielded eyes, with cumbered hands and feet, with clunky tongues? This deed is unattainable. We cannot know each other. I am quitting this thing, but not what you think. I am not going away. I will give you this, my love, and I will not bargain or barter any longer. I will love you. As sure as he has loved me. I will discover what I can discover, and though you remain a mystery, save God's own knowledge, what I disclose of you I will keep in the warmest chamber of my heart, the very chamber where God has stowed himself in me. And I will do this to my death, and to death it may bring me. I will love you like God, because of God.
mighted by the power of God. I will stop expecting your love, demanding your love, trading for your love, gaming for your love. I will simply love. I am giving myself to you, and tomorrow I will do it again. I suppose the clock itself will wear thin its time before I am ended at this altar of dying and dying again. God risked himself on me. I will risk myself on you. And together we will learn to love, and perhaps then and only then, understand this gravity that drew him unto us. Chapter 14. Alone. 53 years in space. I was in love once. I think love is a bit of heaven. When I was in love, I thought about that girl so much I felt like I was going to die, and it was beautiful. And she loved me too, or at least she said she did. And we were not about ourselves, we were about each other. And that is what I mean when I say being in love is a bit of heaven. When I was in love, I hardly thought of myself. I thought of her and how beautiful she looked, and whether or not she was cold, and how I could make her laugh. It was wonderful because I forgot my problems. I owned her problems instead, and her problems seemed romantic and beautiful. When I was in love, there was somebody in the world who was more important than me, and that, given all that happened at the fall of man, is a miracle, like something God forgot to curse. I no longer think being in love is the polar opposite of being alone, however. I say that because I used to want to be in love again, as I assumed this was the opposite of loneliness. I think being in love is an opposite of loneliness, but not the opposite. There are other things I now crave when I am lonely, like community, like friendship, like family. I think our society puts too much pressure on romantic love, and that is why so many romances fail. Romance can't possibly carry all that we want it to. Tony the Beat Poet says the words alone, lonely, and loneliness are three of the most powerful words in the English language. I agree with Tony. Those words say that we are human. They are like the words hunger and thirst. But they are not words about the body, they are words about the soul. I am something of a recluse by nature. I am that cordless screwdriver that has to charge for 20 hours to earn 10 minutes use. I need that much downtime. I am a terrible daydreamer. I have been since I was a boy. My mind goes walking and playing and skipping. I invent characters, write stories, pretend I am a rock star, pretend I am a legendary poet, pretend I am an astronaut, and there is no control to my mind. When you live on your own for a long time, however, your personality changes because you go so much into yourself, you lose the ability to be social, to understand what is and isn't normal behavior. There is an entire world inside yourself, and if you let yourself, you can get so deep inside it you will forget the way to the surface. Other people keep our souls alive, just like food and water does with our body. A few years back, some friends and I hiked to Jefferson Park, high on the Pacific Crest Trail at the base of Mount Jefferson. One evening we were sitting around a campfire telling stories when we spotted a ranger slowly walking toward our camp. He was a small man, thin, but he moved slowly as though he was tired. He ascended the small slope toward our fire by pushing his hands against his knees. When he met us, he did not introduce himself. He only gazed into the fire for a while. We addressed him, and he nodded. He kindly asked to see our permits. We went to our tents and to our backpacks and brought the permits to him unfolded. He studied each of them slowly, staring at the documents as if he had slipped into a daydream. They were simple documents, really, just green slips of paper with a signature. but he eyed them like moving pictures, like cartoons. Eventually, he handed our permits back to us, smiling, nodding, looking awfully queer. And then he stood there. He leaned against a tree only 2 feet from our campfire and watched us. We asked him a few questions, asked him if he needed anything else, but he kindly said no. Finally, I figured it out. He was lonely. He was alone and going nuts. He had forgotten how to engage people. I asked him how long he had been at Jeff Park. 2 months, he said. 2 months? I asked. All by yourself? Yeah, he said, and smiled. That's a long time to be alone, I told him. Well, he said to me, this conversation has worn me out. He put his hands in his pockets and smiled again. He looked out into the distance and stretched his neck to look at the stars. Do believe I will head back to camp, he said. He didn't say goodbye. He walked down the little hill and into the darkness. I know about that feeling. That feeling of walking out into the darkness. When I lived alone, it was very hard for me to be around people. I would leave parties early. I would leave church before worship was over so I didn't have to stand around and talk. The presence of people would agitate me. I was so used to being able to daydream and keep myself company that other people were an intrusion. It was terribly unhealthy. My friend Mike Tucker loves people. He says if he isn't around people for a long time, he starts to lose it, starts to talk to himself, making up stories. Before he moved to Portland, he was a long-haul trucker, which is a no-good job for a guy who doesn't do well alone. He said one time on a trip from Los Angeles to Boston, he had a 3-hour conversation with Abraham Lincoln. He said it was amazing. I bet it was, I told him. Tuck said Mr. Lincoln was very humble and brilliant and, best of all, a good listener. Tuck said prostitutes would hang out at truck stops, going from truck to truck asking the guys if they needed company. He said one night he got so lonely he almost asked a girl to come in. He didn't even want to have sex. He just wanted a girl to hold him. Wanted somebody with skin on, somebody who would listen and talk back with a real voice when he asked a question. Sometimes when I go to bed at night or when I first wake up in the morning, I talk to my pillow as if it were a woman, a make-believe wife. I tell her I love her and that she's a beautiful wife and all. I don't know if I do this because I am lonely or not. Tuck says I do this because I'm horny. He says loneliness is real painful, and I will know it when I feel it. I think it is interesting that God designed people to need other people. We see those cigarette advertisements with the rugged cowboy riding around alone on a horse, and we think that is strength, when really, it is like setting your soul down on a couch and not exercising it. The soul needs to interact with other people to be healthy. A long time ago, I was holed up in an apartment outside Portland. I was living with a friend, but he had a girlfriend across town and was spending his time with her, even his nights. I didn't have a television. I ate by myself and washed clothes by myself and didn't bother keeping the place clean because I didn't know anybody who would be coming by. I would talk to myself sometimes, my voice coming back funny off the walls and the ceiling. I would play records and pretend I was the singer. I did a great Elvis. I would read the poetry of Emily Dickinson out loud and pretend to have conversations with her. I asked her what she meant by zero at the bone, and I asked her if she was a lesbian. For the record, she told me she wasn't a lesbian. She was sort of offended by the question, to be honest. Emily Dickinson was the most interesting person I'd ever met. She was lovely, really. Sort of quiet, like a scared dog, but she engaged fine when she warmed up to me. She was terribly brilliant. I had been living in that apartment for 2 years when I decided to cross the country to visit Amherst, Massachusetts, where Emily lived and died. Back then, I imagined her as the perfect woman, so quietly brilliant all those years, wrapping her poems neatly in bundles of paper and rope. I confess I daydreamed about living in her Amherst, in her century, befriending her during her days at Holyoke Seminary, walking with her through those summer hills she spoke so wonderfully of, the hills that, in the morning, untied their bonnets. My friend Laura at Reed tells me that half the guys she knows have had crushes on Emily Dickinson. She says it is because Emily was brilliant and yet not threatening, having lived under the thumb of her father so long. She thinks the reason guys get crushes on Emily Dickinson is because Emily is an intellectual submissive, and intellectual men fear the domination of women. I don't care why we get crushes on Emily Dickinson. It is a rite of passage for any thinking man. Any thinking American man. I only tell you all of this to show you how bad it gets when you aren't around real people for a long time. I tell you of Emily Dickinson because she reminds me of the first time I thought, perhaps, I had lost my mind in isolation. I know now it was an apparition of loneliness, but I cannot tell you how very real it seemed that evening in Amherst. The other times I had seen her, it was all invention. I was creating her out of boredom. But this was different. I had driven from New York City to Boston the night before and had slept in my car. I stopped in Boston because I was too tired to drive the night. I was so cold under a towel I turned and rubbed against a seatbelt that knotted itself in my back and against the handle of the door that crowded my head. I lay there in the back seat and stared at the roof of the car, thinking about Emily Dickinson. I hardly got any sleep. In the morning I doped up on coffee and started on the last leg of my journey, the leg that led to Amherst. All the pretty girls at UMass were running in their sweats that afternoon, the kids out smoking on the lawn, the trees behind them just sticks of things, just cobalt sky out for a walk. The place is lovely in the winter, very smart feeling, very bookish. The big houses are not close together. Red brick and ivy, long lawns. Across town from UMass is Amherst College. Emily's grandfather started Amherst College because he wanted women to know the Bible as well as men. He was all vision and no hands, it seemed, and the place went bankrupt nearly immediately. The school was saved years later by the man's son, Emily's father, who was not like her grandfather in that he did not believe in the freedom or equality of women. Emily's father kept women down. Austin, Emily's brother, not Emily, was expected by the family to publish, to be a great writer. I was thinking about these things when I circled Amherst College and stopped at the Jones Library, where some handwritten notes from Emily are kept, scribbles mostly, gentle pencil on a yellowed sheet within a glass case. It was like magic looking at them. I felt ashamed because I knew I had been reading her for only a year, and yet I felt as though I knew her. As though we were dear friends, what with her living in the apartment in Oregon with me and all. The man at Jones Library told me where to find the homestead. Not much of a place, he said, and indeed I had passed it on the way into town without knowing it. I thought I would have felt it in my chest or sensed it to my right. I thought it would have been largely marked. I followed the man's instructions and walked from the library down along the shops back toward Boston a mile. Her house is not very much like what you would think. Though it is big, it is not grand, and there is a large tree in front that takes the view. A side door is greeted by concrete steps, the cheap sort, and the driveway has been paved. There is a historical marker, but it is small, and so the first thing a young man realizes when he visits the home of Emily Dickinson is that the world is, in fact, not as in love with her as he is. I wanted to gather the leaves, you know, clean up the place. And I was looking all about the house before making my approach when I saw this thing that was not her, but only in my mind was her, swing open the side door and set a foot quickly on the step. She met my eyes and went white, whiter than she already was anyway, and like a wind she fled back into the house. The door closed as if it were on a spring. For a second I could not move. I wrote in my journal that evening, I saw Emily Dickinson step out of a screen door and look at me with dark eyes, those endless dark eyes like the mouth of a cave, like pitch night set so lovely twice beneath her furrowed brow, her pale white skin gathering at the red of her lips, her long thin neck coming perfectly from her white dress flowing so gently and clean around her waist, down around her knees, then slipping a tickle across her ankles. And then she went back into the house, and it scared me to walk around the place. Penny says it is when they are in their 20s that people lose their minds. She says this is what happened to her mother. And when we talk about it, I think of myself in Amherst, so confident at the thing I saw, and at once confident there was nothing there because Emily is dead. I stopped imagining her immediately. I never told anybody about this because nothing like this happened anymore, so there was no need. And what's more, I couldn't bear to find out that I was going crazy, that I was indeed seeing things. I blamed it on loneliness of the biochemical sort. When a person has no other persons, he invents them, because he was not designed to be alone, because it isn't good for a person to be alone. There once was a man named Don Astronaut. Don Astronaut lived on a space station out in space. Don Astronaut had a special space suit that kept him alive without food or water or oxygen. One day, there was an accident, and Don Astronaut was cast out into space. Don Astronaut orbited the Earth and was very scared, until he remembered his special suit that kept him alive. But nobody's government came to rescue Don Astronaut because it would cost too much money. There was a conspiracy, and they said he had died, but he hadn't. So Don Astronaut orbited the Earth again and again, 14 times each day. And Don Astronaut orbited the Earth for months. And Don Astronaut orbited the Earth for decades. And Don Astronaut orbited the Earth for 53 years before he died a very lonely and crazy man, just a shell of a thing with hardly a spark for a soul. One of my new housemates, Stacy, wants to write a story about an astronaut. In his story, the astronaut is wearing a suit that keeps him alive by recycling his fluids. In the story, the astronaut is working on a space station when an accident takes place, and he is cast into space to orbit the Earth, to spend the rest of his life circling the globe. Stacy says this story is how he imagines hell, a place where a person is completely alone, without others and without God. After Stacy told me about his story, I kept seeing it in my mind. I thought about it before I went to sleep at night. I imagined myself looking out my little bubble helmet at blue Earth, reaching toward it, closing it between my puffy white spacesuit fingers, wondering if my friends were still there. In my imagination, I would call to them, yell for them, but the sound would only come back loud within my helmet. Through the years, my hair would grow long in my helmet and gather around my forehead and fall across my eyes. Because of my helmet, I would not be able to touch my face with my hands to move my hair out of my eyes, so my view of Earth, slowly, over the first 2 years, would dim to only a thin light through a curtain of thatch and beard. I would lay there in bed thinking about Stacy's story, putting myself out there in the black. And there came a time, in space, when I could not tell whether I was awake or asleep. All my thoughts mingled together because I had no people to remind me what was real and what was not real. I would punch myself in the side to feel pain, and this way I could be relatively sure I was not dreaming. Within 10 years, I was beginning to breathe heavy through my hair and my beard as they were pressing tough against my face and had begun to curl into my mouth and up my nose. In space, I forgot that I was human. I did not know whether I was a ghost or an apparition or a demon thing. After I thought about Stacy's story, I lay there in bed and wanted to be touched, wanted to be talked to. I had the terrifying thought that something like that might happen to me. I thought it was just a terrible story, a painful and ugly story. Stacy had delivered as accurate a description of a hell as could be calculated. And what is sad, what is very sad, is that we are proud people, and because we have sensitive egos and so many of us live our lives in front of our televisions, not having to deal with real people who might hurt us or offend us, we float along on our couches like astronauts, moving aimlessly through the Milky Way, hardly interacting with other human beings at all. Stacy's story frightened me badly, so I called Penny. Penny is who I call when I am thinking too much. She knows about this sort of thing. It was late, but I asked her if I could come over. She said yes. I took the bus from Laurelhurst, and there were only a few people on the bus, and none of them were talking to each other. When I got to Reed, Penny greeted me with a hug and a kiss on the cheek. We hung out in a room for a while and made small talk. It was so nice to hear another human voice. She had a picture of her father on her desk, tall and thin and wearing a cowboy hat. She told me about her father and how, when she was a child, she and her sister Posey spent a year sailing in the Pacific. She said they were very close. I listened so hard because it felt like, while she was telling me stories, she was massaging my soul, letting me know I was not alone, that I will never have to be alone, that there are friends and family and churches and coffee shops. I was not going to be cast into space. We left the dorms and walked across Blue Ridge, a beautiful walking bridge on the campus at Reed that stretches across a canyon, fit with blue lights, which, when you look at them with blurred eyes, feels like stars lighting a path winding toward heaven. The air was very cold, but Penny and I sat outside commons and smoked pipes, and she asked me about my family, and asked me what I dreamed, and asked me how I felt about God. Loneliness is something that happens to us, but I think it is something we can move ourselves out of. I think a person who is lonely should dig into a community, give himself to a community, humble himself before his friends, initiate community, teach people to care for each other, love each other. Jesus does not want us floating through space or sitting in front of our televisions. Jesus wants us interacting, eating together, laughing together, praying together. Loneliness is something that came with the fall. If loving other people is a bit of heaven, then certainly isolation is a bit of hell. And to that degree, here on earth, we decide in which state we would like to live. Rick told me a little later I should be living in community. He said I should have people around bugging me and getting under my skin, because without people I could not grow. I could not grow in God, and I could not grow as a human. We are born into families, he said, and we are needy at first as children because God wants us together, living among one another, not hiding ourselves under logs like fungus. You are not a fungus, he told me. You are a human, and you need other people in your life in order to be healthy. Rick told me there was a group of guys at the church looking to get a house, looking to live in community. He told me I should consider joining them. Chapter 15. Community. Living with Freaks. Before I lived in community, I thought faith, mine being Christian faith, was something a person did alone, like monks in caves. I thought the backbone of faith was time alone with God, time reading ancient texts and meditating on poetry or the precepts of natural law, and perhaps, when a person gets good and godly, levitating potted plants or pitchers of water. It seems that way in books. I had read a Christian book about the betterment of self, the actualization of the individual in the personal journey toward God. The book was all about focus and drive and perspective. It was all stuff you did in a quiet room. None of it had anything to do with community. If other people were a part of the Christian journey, they had small roles. They were accountability partners or counselors or husbands or wives. I hadn't seen a single book, outside the majority of books in the New Testament, that addressed a group of people or a community with advice about faith. When I walked into the Christian section of a bookstore, the message was clear. Faith is something you do alone. Rick does not have much tolerance for people living alone. He's like Bill Clinton in that he feels everyone's pain. If Rick thinks somebody is lonely, he can't sleep at night. He wants us all to live with each other and play nice so he can get some rest. Tortured soul. I didn't know what to think about the idea of living in community at first. I had lived on my own for about 6 years, and the idea of moving in with a bunch of slobs didn't appeal to me. Living in community sounded so, odd. Cults do that sort of thing, you know. First you live in community, and then you drink punch and die. It was Rick's idea, though, and he seemed fairly normal in all the other areas of his life. He never mentioned anything about a spaceship trailing behind a comet. He never asked us to store weapons or peanut butter, so I figured the thing about living in community was on the up and up. Just because something looks like a cult doesn't mean it really is, right? The other thing is that at the time I was pushing 30 and still not married. When you are 30 and not married and you move in with a bunch of guys, you look like you have given up. Like you were a bunch of losers who live together so you can talk about computers and share video games. If I lived in community, we would have to have about 5 raging parties just to shake the loser image. But I am not one to party. I like going to bed at 9 and watching CNN till I fall asleep. So I was thinking I could move in with the guys and we could tell everybody we had raging parties, but never actually have them. I didn't know whether to make the move or not. Rick kept bothering me about it. I was living way out in the country, about 30 miles from town, and he kept asking me if I was lonely out there, if I wouldn't much rather move into town with a bunch of guys from the church. He asked if I had the chance to minister to anybody out there in the country. He asked if I was having any influence on the cows. I told him I was having a lot of influence. I wrote books. He laughed. I sat there uncomfortably while he laughed. Books, he said. Brilliant. You write books for people. He couldn't stop laughing. He was being very annoying. I moved in with 5 other guys about a month after talking with Rick. We found a house in Laurelhurst, one of the houses on the traffic circle at 39th and Glizan. We lived across the street from the giant statue of Joan of Arc. You'll see the statue if you come to Portland. I liked it at first. It was a big house, and I got the best room, the room with all the windows. My room literally had windows on every wall, about 10 windows in all. It was like living in a greenhouse. I set my desk in front of the huge window that looked down on the traffic circle and the statue. My friends used to drive around the circle and honk when they went by. I always forgot I lived in a glass room, so I would pull my finger out of my nose just in time to wave back. I went from living in complete isolation to living in a glass box on a busy street. One of the best things about living in community was that I had brothers for the first time ever. We used to sit on the porch and watch cars go around the roundabout. We used to stare at the statue of Joan of Arc and wonder out loud if we could take her in a fight. I have a picture on my desk of the six guys at Graceland, which is what we named the house. People thought we named the house Graceland because we wanted it to be a place where people experienced God's grace and unconditional love. But we didn't think about that till later. We really named it Graceland because that was the name of the house Elvis lived in, and like Elvis, we were all pretty good with the ladies. The picture on my desk is more than a picture of six guys. It is a picture of me in my transition. Not a physical transition, but more of an inner shift from one sort of thinking to another. I don't look all that tired in the picture, but I remember being tired. I remember feeling tired for almost a year. I was tired because I wasn't used to being around people all the time. The picture was taken on the porch. We were all smoking pipes. I was wearing a black stocking cap like a beat poet or a bank robber. Andrew the protester, the tall, good-looking one with dark hair and the beard, the one who looks like a young Fidel Castro, was the activist in our bachelor family. He is the guy I told you about with whom I go to protests. He works with the homeless downtown and is studying at Portland State to become a social worker. He is always talking about how outrageous the Republicans are or how wrong it is to eat beef. I honestly don't know how Andrew got so tall without eating beef. Jeremy, the guy in the Wranglers with the Marine haircut, is the cowboy in the family. He always carries a gun. You'd think Andrew and Jeremy would hate each other because Andrew opposes the right to bear arms, but they get along okay, good-natured guys and all. It is a shame because that would be a great fight. Jeremy wants to be a cop, and he went to college on a wrestling scholarship, and Andrew is a communist. I would try to get them to fight, but they liked each other. Mike Tucker, whom we all refer to as Tuck, was the older brother in the clan, the responsible one. He is the one with the spiked red hair, like Richie Cunningham fused with a rock star. Mike was a trucker for years, but always dreamed of a career in advertising. He moved to Portland and started his own advertising agency with just a cell phone and a website. He posed nude on his brochure, which got him gigs with Doc Martens and a local fashion agency. He freelances every other day and drives trucks the rest of the time. Mike is one of my best friends in the world. Mike is one of the greatest guys I know. Simon, the short, good-looking guy with the black hair and sly grin, was the leprechaun of our tribe. He's a deeply spiritual Irishman here for the year from Dublin. Simon is a womanizer, always heading down to Kells for a pint with the lads or to the church to pray and ask God's forgiveness for his detestable sins and temper. Simon came to America on a J-1 visa. He came to Portland specifically to study our church. He wants to go back to the homeland and start a Christian revival, returning the country to its faith in Jesus, the living God. After that, he wants to unite men and take England captive, forcing them to be slaves to the Irish, the greatest of all peoples, the people who invented honor, integrity, Western civilization, Guinness, and apparently peanut butter and the light bulb. Trevor, the young guy in the picture, looks like Justin Timberlake, like the lead singer of a boy band. He has tight hair that curls just out of the shoot, and he's dyed it blonde. Trev is the kid, the rookie on our team of misfits. He is just out of high school a few years and rides a Yamaha crotch rocket motorcycle so fast that when he lets me drive it, I can hardly keep the front wheel on the ground. He is a learner, with a solid heart like a sponge that absorbs, and he wants to become a very good man. Trevor is one of my favorite people. He is my Nintendo buddy. We yell profanities at each other while playing NFL Blitz. I usually win because he's slow with the fingers. Sometimes, after I beat him in the game,